to Mind Prime Liberty Show with me, Swithin Dobson, and him, Tim Patton. Today we discuss word salad. Now, what do I mean by word salad? What I'm talking about here is lots of these words that are used in political discussion that are very, very rarely defined, and to a large extent just are used either to denote something that is good or something that is bad, and aren't really used very carefully, and tend just to be used as a way to shut down discourse. So the typical words are things like racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, more recently whiteness, privilege, equality, diversity, and even more what you might think of more solid words like democracy or capitalism or socialism, are generally used in a sort of similar sense. So that's the idea for the show today. And the first word I think we should have a look at is racism, because this is probably the most prevalent of all these words. So Tim, what is racism?
Well, I think the best definition for all of them, in particular them, is just heresy by modern day, the modern day culture. You could also call the people who are these are, you know, you could think about this, they're witches. You know, you could, you know, this is actually probably a better word to describe it. A racist is a witch. I think that's a perfectly usable term from anthropology, not from anthropology, but you know, and to a certain extent, we witch hunt racists. I mean, whether or not Charles Murray or some of these other characters, you go further down the rabbit hole, are these things, you know, when Charles Murray shows up to Middlebury, I mean, it's quite clear that he's treated as a witch. It's quite clear he's treated as a witch. So what is the definition of these words? Again, heresy. I think you could try to concoct some definition of the term, but even there, I think it's problematic. I've always found this term to be rather problematic. Here in the United States, you could easily just say, it's a dislike. I mean, I think if you tried to do it, you would say something like, the slaves, ex-slaves of the United States, treating ex-slaves of the South as poorly. But even there, it's problematic because like when Nigerians come to the United States currently, they're some of the richest people in the United States, and they don't experience it, and the Asians don't experience it. They might have experienced it in the 1930s or 40s when they were put in internment camps, but as people like Thomas Sowell points out, Asians make probably more money. Japanese and Chinese Americans make more money. So racism, I have no clear definition for this here in the context of the United States, or for that matter, globally, because it could easily mean ethnicity. I think ethnicism is actually a better term than racism. And B, there are so many different ethnicities. And interestingly enough, there's a lot of ethnicities that hate each other that look very similar. And you read that some, like I was watching Thaddeus Russell recently with Michael Malice, and one of the points is that, like, the Irish, for example, were originally considered basically Africans. And then they were talking about this law in the United States that would eventually culminate in the 1920 to 1965 moratorium on immigration. The Irish became the best kind of whites. If treating Irish poorly was considered racism, It's not entirely clear. It's not entirely clear. And you factor in people like the Greeks, or the Lebanese, or Coptic Christians. It gets very fuzzy. It gets very fuzzy. I mean, maybe the African descendant of slaves, the ADOS. But it's worth pointing out I was also recently watching Thaddeus Russell, and the ADOS, African American descendant of slaves, or whatever you call them. When they travel abroad, they're considered white, funnily enough. So racism, I have no clear definition, other than it's just a word for the left to criticize the right in general, And that's actually anyone to the right of them. So if you're in the far left, you criticize this moderate left as racist as well. Because I'd argue Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, by some standards, are equally quote-unquote racist as Trump. But no one ever cares. I would argue Lincoln is equally racist, as, if not more racist, than Robert Lee. But then again, no one ever really cares if Margaret Sanger, you know, again, the word is thrown around all the time. It just basically means anyone who's critical of Barack Obama. You could actually use that as a definition. So I've thrown out multiple definitions. Swithin, any thoughts?
Oh, I'm thinking, is Thomas Sowell racist? Have you ever heard that being used against him? Because I can definitely see somebody accusing him of it.
I think the term is for Thomas Sowell, as well as Larry Elder and Glenn Gowrie, is Oreo cookie or Uncle Tom. That's the term. So, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Racism as used is just anybody who doesn't agree with complete open borders, complete multiculturalism, and the view that anything that might be wrong in the black or non-white community must be the entire fault of white. That's pretty much the way it's typically used. It has no consistency whatsoever. I'm pretty sure I remember reading a Guardian article which was actually complaining that James Flynn was essentially racist. Now, James Flynn is interesting because James Flynn has debated Charles Murray on IQ disparities amongst races. And James Flynn argues that it's primarily cultural, whereas Charles Murray, I don't know if he's ever completely explicit about this, but he's more on the hereditarian side. So Flynn's very much on it's culture, you know, it's not inherent, you know, you could change it, you know. But now he's been he was recently castigated because he basically said, yeah, some aspects of black culture is kind of dysfunctional. And so basically this old Guardian author was saying, well, any view that the blacks have absolutely no any view that holds the black community in any way responsible for their position must be racist. That was effectively the argument. And you're entirely right with Kamala Harris, Joe Biden. It's a huge, just a tribal term. As I said, probably the best example is Margaret Sanger. It's like, well, you know, she was for abortion. Abortion is good. Yeah, it's United Blacks. Well, abortion good. So it's just hugely selective, and it's as with pretty much all these terms, is a Randian anti-concept more than anything else. Tim, any got anything else on racism, or should we move on to sexism?
Let's move on to the next one.
So, Tim, sexism. How would you treat that? Do you think that's pretty much the same heresy word as racism? How does that tend to be used?
Well, this one is more interesting, and actually, it's probably gonna, whether or not it's the top of the hierarchy in the privilege theory, or it's the second point, you know, which is, you know, if you have a, you know, which group is more oppressed, women or, you know, the blacks, which group is more oppressed in the Olympics? It's not entirely clear which one takes the top title, but for a while it seems like and this, there's a sort of relationship, because a lot of the early feminists, worth pointing out, even the New York Times admits this. A lot of the early feminists, again, were basically classical liberal racists, like almost everyone else at that time. But again, no one wants to tear down any of the statues of the early feminists either. And they weren't really interested in any racial equality. Actually, Margaret Sanger is a classic example of this as well. So again, in terms of sexism, it has a very similar usage. Although this one is more interesting to me because it's much more sharper difference than race. Because you get in these problems where, again, I'm not the big advocate of, I'm anti-advocate. Again, I'm not opposed to talking about it, but I do to a large extent agree with Nassim Taleb's version on race, that the categories are fuzzy and things like that. But nonetheless, the categories for gender are less fuzzy than race. Although you could argue there is a spectrum. And, I mean, again, you get into these questions: how many genders are there? 2, 1,000, or infinite? But there is a more clear test. You can have the chromosomes XXXY, and ability to have children, ability to bear children, and things like that. You have more physical things in general to select them. So does sexism exist? Well, it's worth pointing out that sexism probably exists the other way too. The more suicides, more workplace fatalities are men. Men do worse in school currently. This is actually term misandry, you could call it. Does sexism exist? You know, the Cato Institute a while back came out with a study that said that, well, as far as the pay gap is concerned, it's that actually women between 22 and 28 make like 3 to 5 cents more than men. They came up with that result. So again, now the classic pay gap is this sort of 18 cent difference. But then again, if the capitalists are so profit greedy, why don't they just hire women? So yeah, does sexism exist? I'm not sure. What's the definition of it? Again, I think it's just a witch. It's a heresy. Any person who disagrees with Kamala Harris or Hillary Clinton is clearly a sexist. Even though NYU did a mock study of the 2016 election, found that if Donald Trump were a woman and Hillary Clinton was a man, it'd actually be the Clinton figure would be more unlikable. So it actually argues that the women actually get privileged in this role. And actually, if I was a Republican strategist, I've long thought that running Candace Owens would be the perfect candidate based on modern, because the modern media doesn't know how to deal with these people. Or even Sarah Palin. I mean, again, it's a lot harder to say that Sarah Palin is a sexist considering the fact that she's a woman. Now, I don't really agree with a lot of what Sarah Palin has said necessarily. I'm not necessarily a normie Republican by any means. And again, take Margaret Thatcher. Again, you can bring up a lot of criticism. Sean Gabb probably bring up a lot of criticism of Margaret Thatcher. But again, you know, if Britain is so sexist and patriarchal, you know, why did it elect Margaret Thatcher for X number of years? And of all parties, like the right-wing party did it. So yeah, I'm very skeptical of this usage. There's a lot of special pleading. We tend to leave out all cases which are, you know, the exceptions. And these huge gaping exceptions as well. Swithin, any comments?
I was going to bring up Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher is an interesting example because she's a relatively early female leader, and all the feminists left hate her, like, horrific. They despise her. And I agree with Sean, primarily on Thatcher, but they have a visceral hatred, probably because she's a woman who didn't hold the right views. Because this is what it's all about. You're only a sexist if you hold the wrong views. I mean, so effectively on their view, you know, Margaret Thatcher is a sexist because she's not a radical feminist. I mean, that is essentially the way the term is used. Anything can be described as sexist. It's like, I remember someone complaining that some football manager sent sexist tweets to a friend of his, and it was like, yes, they were describing various parts of female anatomy, and, you know, they're male and they kind of like them, and that's somehow sexist. It's like, well, you might call it lewd, you might call it, you know, you might call it uncouth, or calling it sexist is really kind of odd. It's really not the really sort of a very strange term to use for that. And again, it's all about positions. So the sexist, as it's typically used, is anybody who doesn't agree that women have always, no, that's completely wrong. It's the other way around. But men have always oppressed women. Men are basically better. Women should do everything that men do and not do what they've traditionally done. And that moment and that's, you know, oh, we'll get to equality later. But that's typically how it's used. And so when they get sort of women who don't, even sort of quote unquote, sort of strong women in a certain sense, like Ayn Rand is an interesting example here, because she was saying you shouldn't vote for a woman for a big president because a woman couldn't really be commander in chief. And Rand is hardly the most sort of traditionally conservative, traditional. Yeah, Rand held that view, and then therefore, you know, must be cast aside because of that. So, as I say, that's how sexism is typically used, and any sort of male-female disparity, which is you might consider negative to the women, is sexism. But if it's the other way around, oh, it must be something else. It's not sexism. It's not this mythical word that's doing all the work for you. It's just it's just something else. It couldn't possibly be sexism. That's the way it kind of goes. Tim, any other comments on sexism?
One of the interesting things regarding essentialism in regards to sexism, and this is something that has bothered me for years about feminism, is it's built on the implicit premise that gender exists, which is one of the internal contradictions, I'd say, of the modern left. This is one, like Paul Gottfried would say, they're sitting on a powder keg. And this is one of the things that Dad Russell likes to bring up, is that there's sort of, if you say infinite genders exist, then how exactly are feminists claiming that they are oppressed? And this is where we get in these blurred lines, where there's convoluted arguments that are made where, well, gender exists at times, sex exists at times, but it doesn't always exist. And this is just, to me, a lot of special pleading and so forth, which is where you get, you can, if you can just self-identify as whatever you want, then why not all men just identify as women? Everyone is a woman. You know, would sexism still exist? I mean, that's like a sort of off-the-cuff thought example. But, you know, since people like to, you know, make fun of libertarians with Robinson Crusoe-style experiments, you can easily make feminists with other sort of absurd hypotheticals, too. So it's all self-identified, and there's no sort of biological basis to it, then so what? So, Swithin, any thoughts on essentialism before we move into the other ones?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's certainly true. I mean, the same thing with race. I mean, that's where you get the good old Rachel Dolezal and transracialism. It's like if race is just what you feel like, well, then can it really exist? I suppose the only way you could define it would be, oh, the only people who are racist or sexist are those people who think that they are immutable categories which aren't dependent upon social construction. I mean, that might be the only way that you could use those terms in to use those terms holding such a sort of socially constructivist view. But let's move on to another word. So the next word I had down to look at was homophobia. So Tim, how is that used in your experience?
Same concept. This one's a little more tricky, partly because as a libertarian, and even Sean Gabb, interestingly enough, who we had on this show, libertarians actually been out front on the decriminalization of this action, which I'm totally in favor of, whether that pisses off certain members of the Christian right or certain aspects of the right. Or the early Marxists, it's worth pointing out, were probably homophobic, calling it capitalist decadence, you know, a bourgeois kind of fetishization. I'm a strict libertarian in the sense I think it should be perfectly legal. And actually, libertarians actually were ahead of the curve in this regard. But again, libertarians, since they're not part of the mainstream, don't get credit for that. You know, I think Stefan Kinsella had things libertarians should be. Someone should make a list of what libertarians have been right about, that the culture has adopted. So as far as homophobia is concerned, it's people who aren't sufficiently supporting and affirming who knows what. It's worth pointing out that, you know, if you look at a map of countries that criminalize homosexuality, you know, most of them are in Southeast Asia and Africa. We have Algeria, Chad, Sudan, Papua New Guinea, Malaysia, I think Laos, Cambodia, Saudi Arabia, Iran. These are the countries that criminalize homophobia, homosexuality, which is very contra-libertarian or classic liberal. And again, Christians get, if someone like R.C. Sproul or Ben Shapiro start saying things that actually Ben Shapiro remains a libertarian for the most part on this, from my understanding as well, or at least is now. And most of the conservatives in Western Europe and the United States are libertarians at this issue as well. So whether or not they think it's wrong because scripture says it's wrong, which it's quite, in general, I think it's a basic interpretation, is it's quite clear that that scripture at least doesn't affirm it. And I'm not trying to be overly sensitive to either group here, but I, there is tricky, you can get into sort of tricky, word pyramids where you have the Greek, the Latin, the English, the King James, and so forth. But nonetheless, it's just another witch word. It's never a witch word. And as a libertarian, I get sort of annoyed because the countries that criticize it, are either these sort of Southeastern Asian countries or the Islamic countries. So it's really frustrating usage of it. And I don't see any way in which they currently are gone after. Who gets going after? It's the cake baker in Colorado that gets gone after, because he won't positively affirm it. It's not no one's denying government jobs to homosexualities, to people who are homosexuals. No one's denying government jobs, and if they are, maybe this. And if they are, the governments are doing it. It's the governments that are, we're not allowed to criticize on that basis. So, Swithin, any comments?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, when it comes to which countries are criticized or who's criticized, obviously all the more melanin-enriched countries are given a pass because, given the current cultural system, we expect lesser standards from, non-white people. Therefore, we'll let them off. But we white people, we must be held to the highest possible standards. That's the way effectively they use it. But yeah, I mean, homophobia, I mean the phobia aspect is silly. It's like fear of. It's like, well, you might fear it, and I suppose it could be some sort of quasi-clinical condition that could be a phobia as such. But again, it's just an attack word. It's purely pejorative. It may have been used, reasonably well, those who sort of originally wanted to maintain criminalization of homosexual activity. But now it's kind of, you have to be fully affirming absolutely everything. I mean, interesting examples here. I mean, I don't remember if it was actually called this directly, but there's an English actor who's gay called Rupert Everett, who in 2012 was interviewed by the press and said, "I couldn't think of anything worse than gay parents, like having two dads or whatever. It's like they'd just be horrific." And then he gets piled on because he isn't progressive enough. The goalposts have moved so much so that anything other than complete and utter affirmation of any homosexual family relationship is homophobia. I mean, as I said, some homosexuals are relatively socially conservative. It's like, well, yeah, we have gay lifestyle, and with like marriage and kids and stuff, that should be kind of done the natural way, as it were. They could be decried as homophobic. It's just whatever isn't completely and utterly up to the minute progressivist position on it is somehow homophobic. So next word we had was transphobia. Tim, what's your views on transphobia? This seems to be the newest word, I think, in our list.
This one I'm fairly unclear about. I have not used it enough, but it's just another example of an additional word in the arsenal Swithin, any comments of yourself?
It's anything other than redoing your plumbing is anything other than, you know, the height of virtue, and not sort of 100% going, yeah, you know what, going to an operation, cut it off, redo it, is anything other than perfect. It might also extend to not supporting the use of puberty blockers amongst adolescents and things like that. Again, though, you get the interesting essentialism and sort of constructivism, because this is why the feminists, some of the feminists of sort of like the TERFs, the trans exclusionary radical feminists, like J.K. Rowling, because if you take the trans issue, it's basically, well, who is a woman is, you know, just the way you feel. And then obviously, I'm a man, but I feel like a woman, more than I am one. And then this sort of steps on the toes of sort of traditional feminist arguments of on the oppression of women, because, well, you know, what is a woman, etc. So of all the words that are used on sort of the infighting of the left, this is probably the, at least currently, the biggest sort of bust up. But of course, you know, the pro-trans position is the most progressive position. Have you seen anything similar to that or different?
Oh, yes. The J.K. Rowling point, I would largely agree with. Actually, South Park had a interesting episode recently, which I'm surprised South Park remains willing to take on edgy, politically incorrect topics where they had, I think it was like a professional wrestler who identified as a woman, and he just competed in a bunch of women's sports. Again, I mean, they're just sports, who cares? But at some point, it is sort of silly, you know. And this actually, to a certain extent, in a way, it undermines the premise that men and women are equal. You know, if men can compete in women's sports and just win them all, it sort of undermines the second word we just identified. So it's either a two-category thing or just a spectrum. Now, you know, different aspects of the left disagree on this. But one thing I always notice is there's this kind of, this is how annoying the intersectionality of these things get, is because they'll just sort of always focus their firing squads on some boogeyman on the right. And what I've rarely found this boogeyman. Maybe this boogeyman exists somewhere in North Dakota or northwestern England. You could find this boogeyman. I've never really met one of these boogeymen. I think the point about sports is fairly reasonable. So, Swithin, any comments before we move on?
No, I think that's pretty much it on transphobia. And it's probably a more rare one. Have you ever come across ableism before? This is a more niche one, but it has been around for a bit.
Ableism is interesting. A while back, because I oftentimes think you could fit, because oftentimes you'll see, if you're on the internet long enough time, libertarians get criticized as being people who live in their basements and so forth, and artistic. And I always found that sort of be vaguely as a vaguely ableist argument. So you're criticizing libertarians on the grounds they can't compete in this crony capitalist economy and the education system. And actually, Richard Hanson, there's an article called Richard Hanson, Robin Hanson, pardon. Robin Hanson is the creepiest, America's creepiest economist. And this was an interesting example of those sort of right-wing. And he was just basically pointing out the point that the MGTOW was who wants, you know, people who can't get into a relationship, and saying, arguing that they are in a way oppressed in some degree, because they have a desire, and the desire cannot be fulfilled. And this is where, to me, the left in general, just to a certain extent, falls apart. It's one of the reasons why I'm not a left libertarian either. I don't think all things are available to all people. And nor does everyone want those things. I mean, there's a reason why I'm not Chris Froome. Part of it's work ethic. And Chris Froome is a four-time winner of Tour de France. But there's a reason why I'm not, the Olympic guy that won all the races in the pool. There's a reason. Part of it's genetics. Part of it's work ethic. Part of it's just luck and training. Ableism is, to me, an interesting category. And as far as, like, the disabled things, it's only in wealthy countries like a Britain, like a Japan, like the United States, that have all the ramps and wheelchairs and, if you own a business, you sometimes get grandfathered in. But, like, in the United States, like, if you want to open a barber shop, I think you have to put a chair lift in to get, if you're on, like, the second floor. It's only in wealthy societies that are, I doubt this exists in Russia or Nigeria, that most businesses are wheelchair friendly. Maybe some of them are, maybe the big cities. So it's only in wealthy societies even able to have these things. I doubt that in a person like Stephen Hawking, that's thanks to modern technology that he's allowed to talk. That's not thanks to some, good feelings of the progressive left. Ableism is interesting. I mean, in some ways, we're all disabled in some areas. I'm disabled in my inability to agree with the progressive left, which makes me very unsuitable to getting a job at an American left-wing university. I mean, in that way, I'm quite disabled. It's quite bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, ableism primarily is a function of wealthy Western capitalist nations, although you get the radical disability rights people who claim that, oh no, the world has been constructed in such a way by the quote-unquote able-bodied, which has oppressed the disabled. And I'm kind of thinking, does he think, like, the entirety of the world is like Holland and is flat and there's no hills? Or, it's all just sort of like nice and dandy until those evil people who could use their legs and arms well made things that they had to climb. It is truly bizarre, is ableism. But you do get the idea, though, which is, oh, well, no, if nobody can use it, so if someone can't use it, no one can use it. You get this in, like, children's playgrounds. So you have to have all this play equipment, which is quote-unquote accessible, when I think I've only ever seen one obviously disabled child in a playground ever. And I've been to a lot. And no, that's not because I'm a pedophile. It's because I have four children. Yeah, it's bizarre. That said, there was an interesting article, well, I skimmed it, who argued that there was a form of ableism which kind of did exist, which is those people who defend abortion on the basis of disability. Some will say, they're very badly deformed, therefore we should be able to abort them. Now, obviously, this wouldn't necessarily apply to people who think there's a right to abortion per se in any case. But for those who just say, yeah, it's okay in the case of disability, that is potentially a cogent use of the word ableist. Tim, any other final comments on ableism?
Interesting, this relates to an early episode on suicide. There's an interesting American movie called Me Before You. And the plot is basically this wealthy guy, who's just this playboy character, gets into a car accident. And he basically becomes paralyzed. Now, there's this nurse his parents hire, try to convince him not to go with this forward of his euthanasia. But some interesting commentary on Me Before. He eventually, it's like a romantic comedy that ends in like a quote-unquote, some would call it a tragedy, some would call it a triumph. The ends, he goes to, like, Switzerland or Belgium and ends up doing assisted suicide. But one of the criticisms of the movie itself is it's actually kind of ableist, because technically it is. It's, you know, because this guy can't, you know, he can't run, he can't do these other activities because now he's paralyzed. He therefore is incomplete. And I think it's in many Nordic countries, children with Down syndrome are aborted. Which I always find, again, this relates back to the point about Margaret Sanger. The whole problem with all these words is if you would apply a consistent standard to them, I actually might buy into their usage, but a consistent standard is never applied, in any of these words, which is why I think they're basically meaningless or just swear words.
Okay, the last one for this section, anti-Semitism. What do you think on that, Tim? Are you an anti-Semite?
Well, the real question is Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises anti-Semites? I'm considering the fact that Ludwig von Mises' background, you know, he was in Spain, Portugal, trying to flee to the United States. The Mises Institute, I think, is labeled as a hate organization. So that's the real question. It's worth pointing out again that it's not entirely clear the relationship between I'm not a Nazi in any meaningful sense. And I'm not an anti-Semite in any meaningful sense. I think in the long run, but it's worth pointing out, as far as the actual anti-Semites in Germany, from my understanding, if you start reading the history, the Holocaust started later, the actual Holocaust of the capital H. And actually, they had plans to move into Madagascar, and Americans turned away refugee ships coming from Europe. Many European countries didn't want to take the Jews from Germany either. Again, now does that somehow mean it's okay? Who knows? Probably not necessarily. And as far as today, who wants to kill a bunch of Jews? It's probably like Hamas. And again, as much as I read Keith Preston and some of these other left anarchists who say that, you know, there's a Zionist who are sort of I'm not a Zionist by any means. I don't think the United States should aid Israel. If Israel wants to buy American weapons with its own money, I think Israel should be perfectly allowed to do it. But as far as today, the group that wants to destroy Jews is probably like Egypt, or, well, actually, Egypt has a peace treaty with Israel, and they're actually in quite good terms. They both persecute the Palestinians in that regard. So, you know, we're not living in the 1930s anymore. I don't see that as a meaningful term. There is a conflict between Christians and Jews on theological grounds, but I don't think either group should. But throughout history, both groups were on good enough terms. It's not quite clear that the Muslims treated the Jews much better in their territories. Again, just sort of who's better than who argument in historically. But anti-Semitic, again, is some bizarre relationship to the Nazis, but no one ever really talks about them or can name most of them or what they were actually doing. I think Hitler was basically mistaken, and so forth. So, Swithin, any comments?
A lot of the time, anti-Semitism is brought up when you criticize the state of Israel. If you say Israel is bad, therefore you must be an anti-Semite, which I always think is interesting, considering lots of Orthodox Jews don't like the nation state of Israel. Because they think it's blasphemous, because we haven't rebuilt the temple or things like that. And it's also used if you ever point out any. So what's interesting is what's allowable is to show, oh, no, the blacks aren't earning as much as the whites. That's bad. But then you point out the Jews. Now, if you want to say the Jews are white or not, it's another question. We leave that aside. But if you want to sort of distinguish the Jews, say, from the Anglo-Saxons, for example, and go, oh, no, the Jews are more. Oh, no, anti-Semitism. Another hilarious one was from some Jewish organization. which said an attack on the 1% is an attack on Jews, which is, I just find absolutely hilarious. So you have, again, it's kind of disparities showing that they're kind of doing kind of better than other groups is somehow anti-Semitic. And then, of course, any reference to any Jew who may or may not have been promoting multiculturalism, globalism, banksterism, etc. If you say that, they're involved with it to some extent. You have to say that it's all the Jews, but they were influential Jewish figures. Then that, of course, then brings the wrath of the people like the Ashkenazi Defense League. Oh, sorry, no, it's the Anti-Defamation League, isn't it? But that's effectively how they function. So, yeah. Again, it's just a complete bizarre word. Tim, anything else on anti-Semitism?
I do think historically it did exist, though. This is one where I think it's quite clear it existed. But again, it's a kind of a, it still remains a boogeyman word today. It still remains a boogeyman word today, but unlike the other terms, which are more opaque, like sexism, because sexism has a clear root in biology, or, well, it might, if you're an essentialist, this one's a kind of ethnicity, that has a kind of strange relationship with the other two big monotheisms in the world. So it is the most problematic, it's like, most Christians love Ben Shapiro. A lot of conservative Christians love Ben Shapiro. John MacArthur, a Calvinist, sat down and had an hour-long interview with him. So today, Trump's daughter, Trump's daughter is married to, I think Ivanka Trump is a converted Jew. So again, to call Trump an anti-Semite to me is just, it's just kind of a weird hilarity. Again, if you want to take sort of Keith Preston, left-wing Michael Brooks argue that Palestinians are oppressed, I might agree with you, but then that's a more complicated, just imperial Cold War type exercise. It has nothing to do with 1930s Germany. That's just a historical play that's probably never going to be repeated, because it didn't really turn out very well for almost anyone in the whole play.
So, I think, even though we've looked at all these sort of basic swear words in racism, sexism, homophobia, etc., I think we can actually get some precise, in a sense, definition of the terms and what they actually could mean if they were used consistently. And I thought about this for a while, and I think the best thing I can come up with is an unjustified and malicious disposition, belief, or action based on race, sex, sexual orientation, whether you're cis or trans, what your bodily functions are like, and so obviously on sort of being Jewish and either not politically Jewish, ethnically or religiously Jewish. It seems to me the way the words are used, there's an element of malice. You are a bad person if you are doing this. You're not just mistaken. But you obviously have to be mistaken. Well, to be racist, you have to misapprehend something about another group first, and you must also hold this view maliciously. So in malicious here, I mean, you don't take appropriate regard for that group. So you could say that, yeah, the Nazis are anti-Semitic. Why? Well, because they held unjustified views about the Jews, which they spread disease, et cetera, which was untrue to, I think, a large degree. It may have been true to some certain sense. I don't know. But I suppose it was. And they were malicious. They didn't really particularly care about the Jews as such. And so, wanted to get rid of them. So I think it must be unjustified and malicious. And I would say in most parts, even if you think someone is racist or sexist, et cetera, even if you're having a fair-minded interlocutor, I don't think they think you were malicious in most cases, if they nailed it down. They would just think you were mistaken. So it's, well, Oh, you hold these views on men and women, and well, you just don't understand the evidence. I mean, the evidence shows, you know, that women are equally happy doing all the things that men can do, etc. There's no real sort of brain differences. You know, it's unjustified. But the way the word is kind of used, it's you hold this maliciously. You've looked at the evidence, but you've kind of looked at the you hate women, and then you found evidence to justify your hatred of them. And I think that's kind of, I think, how the word is typically used, even if you drill down, I think it's mostly on the unjustifiedness. So, Tim, what do you think of my concept for a cogent idea of these words?
As far as a cogent concept, I think the maliciousness type is spot on, or at least as the people use it. I actually think this comes from... United States and Britain are both Puritan countries in some ways, Protestant countries in some ways, and particularly Calvinist countries, to be precise. And in Calvinism, you get the idea of total depravity, the idea that everyone's guilty. And this is actually one of the more interesting aspects of these usages. And actually, it's the Moldbug who does not classify, has this idea of hyper-Calvinism. And I think this is a perfect work of sociology on describing all these words. It's maliciousness, and it's a religious word. If religion is what is shared, and heresy is someone who doesn't agree what is shared, now you could argue that, well, we're heretics in the sense that we're the atheists, and in some ways we are, in some ways we aren't, in some ways they might be the heretics, but that is the question in itself. But yeah, your definition about malice is spot on, and I don't think it's a surprise that it came out of ex-Calvinist universities in both Britain and the United States, like Oxford or Princeton or Yale. Whether or not Oxford was capital C Calvinist, it's not clear, but they were clearly influenced by currents in that culture. So, Swithin, any final comments before we finish this episode? It's been quite interesting.
Yes. I was going to say, I think you might be able to reduce it just to malice, although I do think the idea is kind of unjustified as well. And I do think you're right how it comes in sort of Christian Calvinist countries, because I do think a word we could probably spend an entire episode on, you know, kind of equality. Anything that is a sin against that is sort of like the original sin. And that's kind of transmuted from sort of heterodox Christianity into sort of new secular religion of equality, and any crime against that is the ultimate sin. That's the way it's kind of been used.
But let's move on to the next set of words, set three, starting with democracy. I'm going to skip ahead to democracy because I think I'd like to get to this word. Democracy is one of the words that I think today is the most used in the sense that everyone, except maybe like Hans Hoppe, is in favor of democracy. You know, very few people are in favor of aristocracy. I'm not really in favor of aristocracy per se, although it depends on what you mean by what Ayn Rand would thought about that, or F.A. Hayek or someone like that. I do think functional hierarchies exist, and they are quite good. But democracy is quite interesting. I spent about 3 years in a political science program, and actually my final paper was on democracy. I just basically attacked the definition. Political scientists, to me in general, don't have any clear-cut view of democracy, like is Russia a democracy? You know, was the United States in 1860 a democracy? It's not quite clear that, by modern standards, clearly wasn't. Neither women nor blacks could vote. So it was kind of like an aristocracy. He had poll taxes and things like that. So was Russia in 1860 a democracy too? You know, it's worth pointing out that a lot of the lower lords had some power to affect the system. So it is, that is an interesting, that word to me is the most interesting of the set, which has some meat behind it. Swithin?
Democracy is often conflated with liberalism. And so when people say, oh, that's not democratic, well, they mean it doesn't conform to liberalism. But then why think that there's any necessary relationship between liberalism and democracy? And this is the point that Carl Schmitt makes. You know, because all democracy is forms of majoritarianism. Now, who is considered within the relevant group to form the relevant majority is another question. There's no, and then I get the interesting question of what if the majority decide that they want to invest all powers into a dictator for, or a hereditary dictatorship? Is that democratic? Well, yes, in a sense. I suppose you could argue, well, you can't bind future generations, so you'd have to re-vote every certain time. So you maybe make that, but I mean, it's just a word that doesn't really mean a huge amount of things. Except
I want to butt in here. Suppose that the majority decides to vote to kill a minority. Is that example of democracy? I mean, this is the old Carl Schmitt 1930s problem, where you know you can make a chain of logic to suggest that, you know, starting at the Weimar Republic and the clauses within it. You can't. I think Schmitt has the language. I think Keith Preston's analysis on it. You can't. The German Constitution today, you can't subvert the spirit of the Constitution. Which then again, so technically, it's not democracy. The Constitution is in charge. Things within, you can vote on things which the Constitution allows you to vote on. But technically, the Constitution of Germany is actually the ruling authority. And there's certain inalienable rights within that you cannot subvert. So again, democracy has a conflict with natural rights and other things, or even positive rights as well.
Oh yeah, I mean, what really needs to be done here is those people think they're democratic. Well, in most cases, they think is there's a certain political order which they would like, and they think that pragmatically speaking, a form of majoritarianism is a way to achieve it, which is why you get, oh, Trump's a fascist, winning is anti-democratic, etc., which is bizarre. I mean, you could say he's anti-liberal, maybe, yes, and in certain respects, that's probably plausible. So I think the big problem with democracy is trying to disentangle it from liberalism, because if you do want a certain liberal political order, then yeah, it might be the case that a form of majoritarianism is a way to achieve that. But when you say that that's not democratic, I mean, what they're really saying is you're subverting the, sort of the liberal constitution, say, in Germany. So in a sense, that sort of German republic as you, sorry, German constitution as you have now, in a sense, actually makes more sense than sort of pure majoritarianism, unless of course you just want to go down the pure majoritarianism line. That's kind of been raised on some of sort of the pro Brexit branch of saying, oh, people have voted for Brexit, therefore we must leave. It's the will of the people. And so yeah, some of those are moving more towards sort of like mass will of the people. Well, it's interesting, sort of like the pro-EU types are going a more sort of like elitist, aristocratic view. Oh, no, these plebs voted the wrong way. We want this sort of good order, and the EU is aiding the furtherance of this sort of liberal economic and political order, and therefore it must remain. So democracy is interesting in that respect. But as is typically used as the other side of the opposite of fascism. And again, fascism is just generally used to be, well, something I don't like. I mean, that's what George Orwell says. Same with democracy, actually, in the politics and English language. And that's early 20th century. I don't remember the date offhand. And you know, any form of vague authoritarianism is somehow fascism. In the same way that any vague sense of anti-Semitism is sort of like going to resurrect Hitler, in the same way, fascism, any form of fascism means inexorably leads to the Third Reich. And it's just used as for garden variety authoritarianism. as opposed to being a particular historical movement as a response to Bolshevism.
All right. The final word of today, and the word salad, will be freedom. I think this is the sort of Kantian thing in itself, in all these words, in feminism, in democracy, and anti-Semitism, is freedom. And I think Lenin, sort of the freedom from whom, the sort of Lenin-Zizek question of, you know, freedom for the proletariat, or is it freedom for the bourgeois? You know, freedom for the Christian. And this is where you know, freedom for the Catholic or freedom for the Protestant. This is the political problem in itself under liberalism in general, which I'd say in some ways we're both still liberals. I'm not a reactionary, unless if you define reactionary as meaning anyone who is not like a progressive. I'm still in broadly an advocate of freedom, including freedom of homosexuality, just like Sean Gabb. Whether or not the NAP or things like that is coherent is of some question. But the real question for freedom, and I think it's used in an incoherent way by the mainstream, because it's the open political question. You know, what exactly is freedom? And then we get back to the old problem, the old Walter Block, can you sell yourself into slavery dilemma, which sort of relates, sort of ties in all the other words. Because if you take the sort of feminist understanding of marriage is a kind of a slave contract foisted upon women by society. If you take that understanding of marriage, then in a way, women are selling themselves into slavery, but perfectly educated women will do this. Some will actually go out and join, European women will actually join and become like ISIS brides, which probably is the more extreme case. But in the United States, it's not clear that the Amish women are oppressed and making a choice against the will. Maybe some of them are. If I look at the Duggars or some of these other popular Christian mega quiverful type families, it's not even quite clear that those women are quote unquote oppressed in any meaningful sense. So this is the word I think is most interesting. But the mainstream doesn't have a clear definition. In particular, the progressive left, freedom for them is always changing, and it's always this sort of new word that yesterday's group is now the enemy of freedom. Swithin?
Freedom is largely a nebulous concept, because what does it mean to be free? Free from something or free to do something? You only get the whole debate between sort of positive and negative liberty. And I think largely it comes down to, what is the conception of a good life? And whatever is consistent with that is freedom, and what's against it is unfreedom, slavery in a generic sense. Yeah, so very few people will think just making your own decisions, irrespective of what those decisions are, is good. I mean, some people will take the position that, just leave people and do whatever they want, and that's absolutely fine, and there's nothing bad about it, even in some sort of aesthetic sense. This is interesting, like trans-ableism. Is it freeing to make yourself blind? Because some woman did that. She identified as being blind, even though she was normally sighted, but then got a doctor or somebody to throw acid in her eyes or something, so she was blind because that's what she wanted to be. It's like, well, is that a free act? Does that improve her freedom? Well, she chose to do it, but does it really impair with her normal state of being? Yes. Can she do fewer things now than she did before? Yes. Is that free? Well, maybe. So I think you really get to a big discussion of like positive and negative liberty. And I think really most people have a positive conception. Some libertarians will say, well, no, it's all about negative liberty. But you can see this in libertarian culture wars between sort of the left and right. Is what they care about really is a particular social and political order which they want to achieve, and libertarianism is effectively the means to achieve it to a large extent. And so depending on what their visions are of the said society, that sort of changes what they think sort of libertarianism is, in a way, as it were, and kind of what freedom is. Tim, any comments?
As far as the characterization that's positive, I would agree as well, that the conception is positive. That's why most socialists, and Christopher Hitchens made this point on his book on Orwell as well. Yeah, I think Russ Roberts and Orwell had a great Christopher Hitchens Great Conscience conversation. Orwell, Orwell was a socialist, and he was a firm advocate of freedom. He just thought that, you know, like the national healthcare system improved national healthcare system, British improved the citizens, English people's freedom. This is where I think libertarians in the long run have the winning hand. I don't think large state-centered healthcare systems. And this is why I'm a libertarian. I might not be a libertarian for the culture war issues. I think it's theoretically true in the Walter Blockian sense. I think it improves people's conditions. But freedom, again, totally relates back to, you know, purpose, teleology, and what is the good life. But in general, all these words, including freedom, have nebulous definitions. And the first set of the words are just swear words. I don't think freedom is a swear word. I don't think democracy is a swear word. That's a technical problem. Because you even get Tory conservatives who will argue, well, actually sort of sounds like Christian Protestants will argue that, well, Christians should be able to vote, but they should vote for what the New Testament supports. From my understanding of certain Amish practices, there is some kind of democratic assemblyism in as well as Puritan North America. Now, what exactly they vote on is of some question. Whether Christians can vote democratically is some question we don't want to get into. But in general, the second set of words I don't think are swear words. Swithin, any final comments?
I would say democracy isn't a swear word. It's a good word. Democratic means good, and so does freedom is good. Fascism is a swear word, and something we didn't get to. So if you're sort of an ANCAP, capitalism, it means good. If you're a capitalist, that's a good thing, although they would tend to have a more cogent definition. But then if you're a capitalist, and if anyone else is not you, you're a socialist. That just means you're bad. And vice versa, if you self-identify as a socialist, you're a capitalist, that means you're evil. But if socialism means you are good and you are part of the in-group, you are one of the good guys. So these words are kind of used depends who use them, whether they're pejorative or otherwise. Although I don't really know many people use democracy pejoratively, probably apart from Hans Hopper and maybe me on occasions, which they're not sort of like universally bad in the way that the first set that we discussed were. But thank you, everybody, for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends and family. And please subscribe to us on YouTube and on Podbean. And if you'd like to get into contact with us with any ideas for the show or any things you think we should cover, please contact us at mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com. That's mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com.